United States and the United States president have committed 3 or 4 mistakes already, and the summit hasn't even taken place yet.
A proposed U.S.-North Korea presidential summit poses questions. It's Monday, November 12th. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, avoiding pitfalls in North Korean talks, China formally abolishes presidential term limits, Australia and East Timor reach historic agreement, global obesity widening, super strong wood. It's all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. officials vowed Sunday they would not make any concessions to North Korea and continue to pressure the Pyongyang regime ahead of a planned summit between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. White House spokesman Raj Shah told ABC News, "The president has not adopted some of the failed policies we've seen over the last several decades, which is negotiations and concessions out of the gate from the United States."
Our policy is pressure. It's pressure from our partners and allies around the world, pressure through the United Nations, pressure through China. These have had an impact, and it's impacted Kim Jong-un's behavior. It's impacted his conduct. So we're hoping that this pressure campaign, which is not going to relent in the coming months, is changing North Korea's behavior.
But skeptics remain about Trump's agreement for a face-to-face meeting with Kim. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with one. Evans Revere is a former U.S. State Department official who continues to take part in dialogue with the North Koreans. However, despite what might seem as a walk back on the talks by some, he believes the United States and North Korean leaders will meet.
I think the meeting, based on everything I have heard from comments from the senior staff in the White House and from the president's own tweets and his appearance in Pennsylvania, would suggest that this event is a go, so to speak, and that the president intends to do this. And the preparation process has begun. So I am operating under the assumption that it will move forward, as ill-advised and ill-conceived as it may be.
Why do you say it is that?
I have been pointing out, and others have been pointing out, that even in this early day, when the initial steps to prepare for this possible presidential summit are being undertaken, the United States and the United States president have committed 3 or 4 mistakes already, and the summit hasn't even taken place yet. Mistake number one, in my view, is that he has given North Korea something it has sought for decades, a face-to-face meeting with the United States president, and he's given it to the North Koreans for free. The second error that I think has been committed is that the president has convinced himself, or he has allowed himself to be convinced, that North Korea has agreed to discuss denuclearization and move towards eventual denuclearization. They have done no such thing. There's no evidence to that, including in the statements from the South Korean envoy. The third error I think that's been committed here is that the president seems to have interpreted North Korea's interest in dialogue with the United States, and this is not a new thing. The dialogue, their interest in dialogue has existed for quite some time, but he has interpreted that interest in dialogue as an interest in resolving the nuclear issue on terms acceptable to the United States. And you can see it in his tweets, and you can hear it in his comments. I've seen no indication whatsoever that that's the case. And then finally, and I'm speaking as a former professional diplomat and someone who's worked very carefully on presidential summits for many years, he has violated, this White House has violated one of the basic rules of presidential summitry, and that is you don't commit the president of the United States to a summit unless you know what the outcome of the summit will be, and unless there's an understanding with your adversary that the summit between the president and your adversary will produce that sort of an outcome. And in order to produce that outcome, you engage in dialogue and diplomacy and negotiation and consultations and discussions. And these can take weeks or months or years. And when the process has been culminated and it's moving into its final stages, and there is an understanding about the agreement that is to be produced, at that point, presidents and heads of state engage. That's the way America has always done diplomacy. And we are on the verge now of replacing that sort of mechanism with a rather impulsive decision that apparently came as a surprise to the American officials who were in the room with the president, and apparently came as a surprise to the Secretary of State, and a rather impulsive decision to go ahead with a meeting with the North Korean leader.
The discussion continues in just a moment on VOA Asia as former U.S. State Department official Evans Revere explores some issues he believes could pose larger problems in dealing with North Korea. These are among some of the top Asia stories currently trending on voanews.com. China places big bet on Xi Jinping, scraps presidential term limits. Hong Kong votes to replace ousted pro-democracy lawmakers. Philippines Duterte gives police officials subpoena power. Australia and East Timor settle long-running border dispute. India and France call for affordable solar technology to address climate change. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and a whole lot more on Facebook at VOA Asia, also on the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson. Announced talks between the United States and North Korea bring unprecedented questions and possibilities. Former U.S. State Department official Evans Revere shares with VOA's Ira Melman what he sees as the potential pitfalls such a meeting at the presidential level presents, and a scenario President Trump needs to be well prepared for.
For 65 years, the United States has been negotiating with North Korea. The best and brightest and most talented U.S. Senior military personnel and diplomats and intelligence officers and others have been at the table developing their expertise, developing a level of knowledge about how the North Koreans operate, understanding the cultural aspects of North Korean negotiating techniques, etc. And now what we appear to be doing is setting aside that expertise and setting aside all we've learned about how to negotiate and how not to negotiate with the North Koreans for this new adventure in which the president himself will take on the burden of negotiating with North Korea. That's not the way we have normally done diplomacy, that we have reasonably senior level diplomats from both countries meet and we try to hash things out. And even when we conclude agreements, the agreements fall apart. What I have been arguing for years is that we need presidential envoys and leadership envoys from both countries who directly represent the respective leaders to meet and to discuss all of these issues and to see if there's any common ground. And the argument that I make is that if you're not talking to the North Korean leader's inner circle or even the North Korean leader himself, that you're probably not going to get the sort of decision and the sort of results that you want. But that's not a job for the United States president. That's a job for a presidential envoy or a secretary of state or a very special representative of the American president who should be engaged in this process, who should be doing the heavy lifting, supported by the experts, the language experts, the folks who have experience at the negotiating table with the North Koreans, the folks who've learned all of the tricks of the trade. Keep in mind, we're talking about a North Korean negotiating style that thrives on cunning and deception and deviousness. And we have people who've been at the table with the North Koreans and understand this. Those should be the people at the table advising an American senior envoy about how to go about pursuing denuclearization with North Korea. It shouldn't be the president of the United States. That's not the way we do diplomacy. It's very dangerous. It's very risky. And I fear that the president is going to be walking into a trap. And if you'd like to know what the trap is, I can explain it to you.
Let me hear it.
Yeah. the North Koreans, for quite some time, have been trying to force the United States to make a binary choice. The binary choice being accept North Korea as a de facto nuclear weapon state and deal with North Korea as such, or be prepared to go to war to prevent North Korea from developing these capabilities. The North Koreans have been convinced that at the end of the day, the United States will opt for the former, basically accepting and recognizing North Korea. And at that point, the president has to make a decision. And at that point, I believe the North Koreans will also say, in order to show our good faith, we are prepared to freeze our nuclear weapons and missile programs at their current level. And that is the equivalent of leaving in place, with U.S. agreement, a North Korean nuclear threat against ourselves and our allies. And they would attempt to force the American president to agree to that package. I think that's the trap he may be walking into.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking with former U.S. State Department official Evans Revere, who was involved in years of discussions directly with North Korea and is now a senior advisor to the Albright-Stonebridge Group in Washington. Happening now in Asia, Hong Kong saw low turnout numbers for an election Sunday to replace four lawmakers disqualified over oaths last year the Chinese government deemed improper. The vote pits pro-Beijing loyalists against opposition candidates who worry if they don't win some of the seats, they will not have veto power. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us at the start of yet another week here on VOA Asia. In the short space of 2 weeks, China has announced and now voted on with near unanimous approval to amend the country's constitution and give the party state powerful leader Xi Jinping a mandate to stay in office indefinitely. On Sunday, a controversial amendment to scrap a two-term limit on the office of the president was approved along with 20 other changes. The amendments passed smoothly in the largely rubber-stamped National People's Congress with only 5 dissenting votes. The decision to scrap a two-term limit to the president's term in office was divulged to the public only in late February. Discussion of the topic has been banned on social media, and the government has taken swift measures to silence even the smallest amount of discontent. Speaking after the amendments were passed, NPC official Shen Chenyao said the decision to scrap the presidential term limits has a broad consensus nationwide.
The trinity of China's leadership, the head of the party, military, and country, suits our national conditions and is realistic. It is a successful arrangement that we, the party, have explored and developed over a long period of time.
Shen did not say why Xi Jinping needs to stay on beyond 10 years or even how many terms in office he might serve. One key concern the Communist Party's argument ignores is the country's history and why the limits were instituted in the first place. To ensure a predictable transition once every decade and to avoid some of the disastrous policy decisions and political turmoil that occurred when China's founder Mao Zedong was in office. Shen Chenyao called such concerns non-existent.
In its more than 90 years of history, the Chinese Communist Party has overcome a series of hardships and a wide range of big problems, questions, and difficulties. There will be no turmoil or anything of the like. Things will be stable.
But concerns are not likely to go away anytime soon, and some analysts argue that Xi's indefinite rule will have an impact not only at home, but on Beijing's efforts to grow its influence overseas as well. Sung Chen Yuan, an associate professor at Tsinghua University in Taiwan, says that under such circumstances, who would dare to challenge or transcend Xi or offer him any advice on national development? And he said that is dangerous.
Shall Xi make mistakes in his policy decisions or take a wrong turn on the country's future development? There won't be any mechanism to make corrections beforehand or hold him accountable afterwards. that will put China at great risk. Today's vote has clearly shown that the Constitution is used as a political tool to rule the people and reflect the top leader's political will.
Our thanks go to VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Hyde and Joyce Huang for contributing this story. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news from VOA Asia. Japan marked the 7th anniversary Sunday of a deadly earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear disaster that devastated its northeastern coast. More than 18,000 people died or went missing after the disaster. More than 70,000 people still remain displaced and continue to live in temporary housing. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, East Timor and Australia have agreed on a maritime boundary for the first time. The historic deal ends a decade-long dispute between the neighbors over rights to rich oil and gas reserves in the Timor Sea. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports the agreement was signed at the UN headquarters in New York after negotiations in the International Court of Arbitration.
The treaty will give East Timor, one of the world's poorest countries, the majority of any future oil and gas revenue in the Timor Sea. In 2002, East Timor, also known as Timor-Leste, gained independence from Indonesia, but no permanent maritime boundary was established with Australia. Disagreements over rights to oil and gas reserves have festered ever since. The new deal means the East Timorese will receive at least 70% of revenue from Greater Sunrise. It's the largest oil field in the Timor Sea, worth an estimated $40 billion, but it has yet to be mined. Meanwhile, negotiations continue over sharing the field. Australian Foreign Minister Julie Bishop.
It is a landmark event, not only for our two nations, but also for international law. Both our governments have deemed this to be a just and equitable outcome.
The agreement was signed at the United Nations in New York after negotiations in the International Court of Arbitration. Under a groundbreaking process of compulsory conciliation, East Timor had taken on Australia, its bigger and more powerful neighbour. East Timor's Borders Minister Argio Pereira says justice has prevailed.
So much work needs to be done after today, but what we wanted to achieve when we instituted this process of conciliation has been achieved. That is the permanent maritime boundaries.
The treaty is crucial for East Timor's economic future, given its over-reliance on diminishing royalties from other resource projects. The government in Dili said the signing of the deal was a momentous day. The UN has praised the vision and determination of both nations in achieving a historic agreement. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This news from VOA Asia. French President Emmanuel Macron has pledged over $850 million for solar projects in emerging economies. Both India and France called for affordable solar technology for emerging nations at the first conference of the International Solar Alliance held in New Delhi. Power your day with great stories and features on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the World Health Organization says the problem of obesity worldwide has tripled since 1975. And it's not just a problem in high-income countries such as the United States. A growing number of people are being diagnosed as overweight and obese in low- and middle-income countries. Being overweight has been connected to more deaths globally than being underweight. VOA's Elizabeth Lee looks at the reasons and a solution that starts with the mind.
Los Angeles resident Kathleen Mulcahy has been fighting with her weight for 55 years. My parents had a baby, a son, and he died at birth. And so that was sort of, I was seven, and I think that was the time I started gaining weight. My mother died when I was 12 very suddenly, and then my weight just escalated.
She is not alone. A growing number of people are overweight or obese, particularly in urban areas worldwide, including developing countries.
Fast foods, transnational corporations, soft drink companies going into these developing countries are having a very huge influence on the overweight and obesity epidemic because they're adding calories and processed foods, salt and sugar into the diet that these people have not normally been eating.
People's lifestyles are also changing in developing countries.
As people urbanize and make more money and have more sedentary lives, they are also putting on weight and following the pattern of the United States.
Psychotherapist Dina Solomon says there is also another reason why people are gaining weight globally.
You know, people are moving away from their family of origin. They don't have a support system that's going to help them also manage and have relationships as options for dealing with stress. So people are turning to food.
While fad diets may help with quick weight loss, keeping off the weight is more of a challenge.
At sustaining that weight loss, the studies overwhelmingly show that plant-based diets are good long-term.
You're motivated.
Instead of focusing on what you eat, Solomon helps people maintain weight loss by working with the mind to change a person's eating behavior. She helps her clients, like Mulcahy, be more self-aware by having them write down everything they eat before they eat.
That awareness, that sense of conscientiousness, becomes more powerful than the immediate gratification of food. But you have to learn it. It has to become a habit.
It's worked for Mulcahy, who has sustained her current weight for almost 3 years.
You get such a sense of accomplishment and a sense of power and efficacy that you can apply it to everywhere.
Maintaining a healthy weight not only helps with a positive self-image, but it will also fend off health problems such as heart disease, diabetes, and even some forms of cancer. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
A new super material, stronger, lighter, and cheaper than steel, has emerged from scientists' labs. And it's not a high-tech nanopolymer or some new alloy. It's wood. VOA's Steve Barragona has more.
Metal screwdriver meets wood. Wood splinters. Metal screwdriver meets super wood. It hardly leaves a scratch. With just some solvents, heat, and pressure, Liangbing Hu at the University of Maryland and colleagues made wood that is 3 times denser and 10 times stronger.
We're interested in replacing steel and the carbon fibers by strong wood structures. So you can be, they can be lightweight, strong, and low cost.
Hu is finding new ways to use wood. He and his colleague, Tung Li, have made wood batteries. They made transparent wood.
Wood has been existing on Earth more than 1 million years, and human beings have been using wood for furniture, constructions more than 10,000 years. And then the more we worked on this material, we realized we haven't never fully exhausted the potential of this amazing material.
The key to superwood, Hu says, is partially removing a chemical called lignin.
So the lignin is like a binder to hold all the components together in a natural wood. And in our process, we found out to be able to densify the wood completely, we have to remove some of these binders.
By removing about half the lignin with chemicals and pressing the wood for a day or so, they say it's strong and light enough to build cars, airplanes, wind turbines, and more with it. There's still more work to do, but Li and Hu say someday, lumber mills may take the place of steel mills. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us all over online, including iTunes and SoundCloud, streaming each and every day on VOA Asia Facebook and on our website at voanews.com. Not only can you find today's program, but you can find programs that aired earlier. There are some topics of interest. Go check it out. We'd also love to hear from you. Find out what you're up to. You can write to us on VOA Asia Facebook and also by email, voaasia@voanews.com. We thank everybody who is listening on the radio today, including Those in Quezon City, the Philippines, via DZUP 1602 AM radio at the University of the Philippines, Diliman, thanks for tuning in. Our thanks go to Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Zainab Abdel-Rahman, Managing Editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Bird as well. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Have a great day.